It gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for today. It's Robin Chasden, who's Professor Emerita at the Ecology and Evolutionary Biology Department at the University of Connecticut. And she has worked for a long time on successional dynamics and restoration and the forest ecology in neotropical forests. She's had a number of senior positions. She's currently Executive Director of the Association for Tropical Biology and Conservation, and she was Editor-in-Chief of Biotropica, the journal. And more recently, she's moved into the science policy arena and has taken on a number of roaming positions. She's Research Professor at the with the Tropical Forest and People Centre at the University of the Sunshine Coast in Australia, and also Senior Research Associate with the International Institute of Sustainability in Rio in Brazil. And a senior fellow of the World Resources Institute Global Restoration Initiative as well. So keeps herself busy and wandering the planet's restoring forests. And she's also published a lot, but in particular recently had a book, Second Growth, The Promise of Tropical Forest Regeneration in an Age of Deforestation, that was published a couple of years ago. So welcome, Robin. Just to mention, after this seminar, we have informal drinks and discussion in the Gilbert Room, which is just around the corner. So do feel free to all of you to come and join and carry on discussions over a glass of wine just around the corner. So welcome, Robin.
Thank you very much, and thank you for coming and inviting me to give the talk today. So I'm going to focus on sort of a thread of research that actually started very much at the plot level in Costa Rica, and slowly grew and reached outside of borders of countries, and eventually became a very large-scale analysis. And I think it's interesting because we did not start out our research with that big picture worldview in mind, and that only became a possible direction after we started seeing what we could do with our smaller research network. So just keep that in mind. If you're starting out doing something small, it doesn't necessarily stay small. And there are lots of opportunities to really collaborate and make something much, much bigger than any one study can do. So this lovely forest was a pasture 30 years before I took this picture. And I love this picture because nothing really expresses this more than seeing or being in a second growth forest that has been able to regenerate naturally under optimal conditions. In this case, there are some large extensive areas of mature forest in the vicinity. There's streams, there's water, there's very humid climate, and this is a go-go-go situation for natural regeneration. And now this is becoming part of a research area in the Osa Peninsula in Costa Rica. But 30 years ago, it looked like this. And it's important to keep in mind when we're out there looking at the land use changes that have occurred in the tropics that this is a dynamic situation. It was forest 20 years ago, it's pasture now. What is that going to be, or what could that be in another 20 years? And this is the point of view now that those of us who are working in restoration have when we go out and we look at deforested areas or degraded areas. They do not need to stay the way they look now, and they can be transformed by a variety of mechanisms. And one of those is natural regeneration, where we don't necessarily have to plant actively the trees, but nature itself can plant them. This is important from a number of perspectives, including biodiversity, but today I'm going to focus on the carbon perspective and the importance of regrowth forests in capturing CO2 globally. Here we go. When you convert a forest and clear it and burn it, there's a huge amount of carbon dioxide that is released from the standing vegetation, and in some cases from the soil when the land is tilled. So we can prevent that from happening by not clearing the forest. But once the forest is cleared, the regrowth of the forest again will absorb and sequester and store CO2 in the vegetation and in some cases also in the soils. And this has been not as widely appreciated as it could be. Most of the emphasis in RED and on incentives has been focused on keeping forest ecosystems intact, which is certainly very important. I'm not saying that we shouldn't focus on that. But this aspect has not been as discussed as it could be. So that's why I want to focus on that. And another issue is that there is this tendency to solve the problem of deforestation by planting trees. And again, I think this has also neglected the potential for trees to plant themselves, which can be result in substantial cost savings and has a host of other benefits as well. This is an area in Costa Rica, in the region where I've conducted my research. All the forest that you see there is natural regeneration of several different age classes. The oldest is back here on the ridge, and this is more recent. So under the proper conditions, forests can regrow on their own. And along with that, they bring their mutualists, they bring a huge diversity of species. They are storing genetic diversity. There's a lot of advantages of letting or ecosystems assemble on their own. So what happens with the carbon, I will simplify this a little bit, but when trees are actively growing above the ground and their photosynthesis is absorbing CO2, and that CO2 circulates in a variety of processes, it can be exported to roots, it's falling down with leaves in the litter, and then the CO2 gets respired again from below the ground. But as trees grow and grow in biomass, roughly 50% of that biomass is carbon. And if that tree remains alive for a long time, that is long-term carbon storage. So this is a way to reduce the carbon that's been emitted. And forest regrowth is a substantial sink for carbon. That has been established at small ecosystem scales. So what I'm going to talk about today are a variety of things. I'll sort of go through the roadmap. First, I'm going to talk about some studies that look at carbon stocks over time as forests are undergoing succession. Then I'm going to talk about some studies we've been doing in northeastern Costa Rica that actually look at the demography of this as forests are recovering and how different processes of recruitment and mortality and tree growth are actually causing the changes in above ground biomass. Then we're going to be looking at these same processes but in a series of six sites that span a wide range of rainfall and seasonality patterns in the Mexico, Costa Rica, and Brazil. And then talk about a major study that we've done to look at biomass recovery at a very large scale within the lowland neotropics. And finally, discuss the consequences of forest regrowth for carbon mitigation in the lowland neotropics. So this is a study in the Osa Peninsula where the very first picture was, where there's been a lot of abandonment of cattle pastures and subsequent forest regrowth. And what we did here was set up a series of 20 plots, each a half hectare, in various regions, various age classes. Some of these are primary forests. Some were 10-year-old second growth forests. And we had five in each age class, in the northern zone as well. And we looked at all the different compartments. So we looked at biomass in the litter layer, and we found not a huge successional story here, but it does increase after 30 years and is the highest in the primary forest. Sorry, that one. A couple of slides in Spanish here. This is the biomass in dead wood, which is fairly low initially and is actually highest in the mature forest because you have large tree falls. And this is the carbon in the soil, in the top 30 centimeters of soil. And interestingly enough, we didn't see any strong trend here with age of forest. And this has been shown in a variety of other post-pasture succession studies, because there's not really loss of soil carbon in most cases during conversion of forest to pasture. It's mostly when forest is converted to cropland, tilled cropland, that you lose the soil carbon. So most of the story about carbon uptake in Latin America, where we're mostly talking about abandonment from pastures, is the above-ground carbon story. So that's what I'm going to be focusing on from now on. And here's our calculation of total above-ground biomass and then total above-ground carbon across these different successional stages. And as you can see, by 30 to 50 years, we have more than half of the total above-ground carbon present in these forests compared to the old-growth forests. So it's a very rapid process. Sorry. I keep forgetting to fix this slide. The black bars are the soil below-ground carbon, and the blue bars are the above-ground carbon. And there is a substantial amount of soil of carbon in the soil, but as I said before, that's not changing significantly during succession. So the big increases that we see are in the above-ground part. Sorry about that. We also looked at the wood density and the carbon content of different tropical trees, and this is something that we're beginning to get more insight. Not all trees have 50% of their biomass in carbon. There is quite a bit of variability. And we were trying to see if there was any successional trend to this variability or species trend. And what we found is that the carbon content does vary quite a bit. And in some cases, for example, in Tetrathylaceum, we found that the carbon content was positively correlated with wood-specific gravity. But that wasn't a universal trend among the species that we looked at. And we didn't find any particular relationship between carbon content and tree diameter. But we did find a tendency for some species to vary, but we didn't assess all of the species in the forest. So this was just sort of some inkling that there's more going on, there's more to the story in calculating carbon content. Then in northeastern Costa Rica, we've been doing long-term studies since 1997 on a series of one-hectare forest plots, and these are revisited every year. The new recruits are marked and identified, and any growth rates of trees are measured, and any tree mortality is tallied. So we've been following the dynamics of these forests. We're going to be getting our 20th year of data this year. It's not easy keeping a project going for 20 years. I'd be happy to talk about that later. But we've become intimately aware of all of these trees. They're all of our friends. And also, we have a series of local technicians who are very highly trained, and they're doing all of this work. We are seeing dynamics. We're seeing some trees that are dead or dying and tree falls, and we're starting to see this whole forest dynamics process happening in our sites. So that motivated us to look at what's happening with tree biomass change in our forests, and I wanted to wait until we had a nice long trend of data before I published this, and it's turning out to be a pretty nice study. What our model for this is that as the stand grows, it goes through different stages of succession. And in the stand initiation stage, it's dominated by tree recruitment and tree growth. The stand is just growing. We're adding new trees. We're adding new species. And we're seeing a lot of increment, a very rapid increment of biomass. And that biomass can be divided into three categories of trees. The second growth specialists, the generalists, and the old growth specialists. And in the lightest blue are the second growth specialists. And those are the ones that dominate the initial stage of succession. They're the ones that are holding the biomass. During the stem exclusion stage, we see some mortality of those pioneers, those early successional species, which tend to be the second growth specialists. We start to see an increasing role of the generalists coming in here and a slow and steady increase in biomass of old growth specialist trees that are beginning to establish in the understory, slowly coming into the forest. This is the pattern we expect in an old growth forest, where very little of the biomass is held in these second growth specialists, and most of it is in generalists and old growth specialists. So we kind of tested this model, looking at which factors are most important for biomass change: tree growth, increment growth, recruitment of new trees, or mortality of existing trees. So we found that the annual rate of biomass change is very high initially, and that rate is shown here on the right. The change, the annual change in biomass, starts to decline over time. And our earliest sites were about 10 years old. We don't have data for the first 10 years of succession. So at some point, we'd see that increasing and then rapid, and then starting to decline here. And this is what we have in our two old growth sites. There's a lot of annual fluctuation. Some years you've got more trees dying than others. So things can dip down fairly low if you have a number of trees dying. This is the standing biomass changes over time. And this is a mixed linear model, so we're able to look at how much of these effects are due to age. It's a fairly significant but not a very high predictability from stand age. But there's a lot of individual site effects going on here as well. So we have high spatial variability and high temporal variability, but we have this overall trend, increasing stand biomass and declining annual rate of biomass change. Then we broke that down into the species that are contributing to biomass change. So these are the second growth specialists, and as in the earlier age classes, we see they're more than half of the biomass is being contributed by those. And that's not that different when you go to the older size class. So there's a big change happening between second growth and old growth in terms of who is composing that biomass. And that's following the model that I showed before. We also found there is also significantly lower biomass in the 25 to 41 year age class compared to old growth, which is not a surprise. It takes quite a long time for forests to completely recover their biomass, but they have recovered about 60% of their biomass by this time. So how does the annual biomass break down when you look at these different demographic processes? Here are the annual rates broken down into these three ages, and the earlier age class, 10 to 24 years, by far has the largest annual increment of biomass. So that's where the forests are actively growing. There's not much mortality happening. And as you can see here, this is mostly due to increment growth, the change in biomass due to increment growth. It's actually high in both of these age classes. And tree growth actually goes down in old growth forests. The change in biomass due to recruitment is relatively low and doesn't vary significantly during succession, according to our data. And that's the reason why it's low is that these are very small trees. So in our study, a tree that reaches 5 centimeters is a new recruit. So they're not, even though there may be many of them, they're not adding up very much to total biomass, which is influenced a lot by tree diameter. Now, this is the mortality, and what you can see here is that when you get to the 25 to 40-year age class, the loss of biomass is greatest. There's the greatest amount of total tree mortality, and that is what's making the difference over here. So they have pretty similar increment rates, pretty similar recruitment rates, But these forests are not losing trees as much biomass to mortality as in the older size class. So what's going on here? What's going on here is that the trees that were growing very quickly in this age class, many of them are dying in the next age class. So this is a kind of like a growth mortality trade-off, but it's happening in time in second growth, whereas in old growth that usually happens in space. And because of that, the curve of biomass increase is starting to level off. It doesn't continue to be linear forever because these trees start to die. This is just also looking at the changing contribution of biomass in these different categories. And in the old growth forest, you can see that, recruitment of the generalists and old growth specialists is increasingly important, whereas we have relatively little contribution to biomass change from recruiting old growth specialists during succession. So it's dominated by generalists here and some old growth specialists. Palms are also an important part of the story in the old growth forest in their biomass. But if you look who's dying, so who's contributing to that decline in biomass due to mortality, it's these second growth specialists here. So they come in, they grow fast, but they don't live very long. So the big picture in terms of the dynamics, this is the change every year, is this is the overall pattern due to increment growth, and this is the overall pattern during for mortality. They're both showing declines in biomass change over time, and recruitment seems to be relatively unimportant after the first 10 years of succession. So we now know that the demographic factors that are really affecting biomass change are tree increment growth and tree mortality. So we applied this same kind of analysis to a set of sites that cross different climatic boundaries within the neotropics as part of a research network that we formed in 2007. And that we've just finished our 10 years of working together. And this was a little trickier because we had to try to match the age categories of the forests, and the studies were initially set up independently and had different actual ages of forests that they were able to study. So our study areas spanned from Mexico to dry forest regions, three dry forest regions, and a wetter forest in Chiapas, the northeastern Costa Rica, and central Amazonia. And this is the age distribution of the stands that we had in our site. So you can see it's really hard to start matching this when you expand your research effort, because this is a reflection of the landscape and the kinds of land use changes that have been occurring. Here's some of the research partners, Miguel Martinez and Franz Bongers, Madeline Lobeck, who worked in the Mexican forests, and Natalia Norden, who was a postdoc, Paula Melli, who was working in Chiapas at the time, and Braulio Santos. And this is the technician who actually gathers all the forest data for sites in Mexico. So here we have the actual changes in above ground biomass over time in all of these sites. And the Chamela site, we have data only every 3 years, so it's not as continuous. But you can see a trend. These are from the driest up to the wettest, and you can definitely see a trend toward higher rates of biomass accumulation over time as you go from dry to wet. You can also see a lot of variability within each of the sites when you start looking at these annual changes. And this was something that, until we started doing this collective project and pooling our annual data together, we really didn't, we expected things to fall more into place and that the sites would actually follow a strict sort of, that we were testing whether they'd follow this chronosequence plan. And in fact, they show similar trends, but their behavior is erratic sometimes, and you get increases and decreases in different sites. And that is the way it is. when we broke it down into younger versus older stands, which is something that we were able to do, we found that a very strong climatic effect. So with increasing rainfall, there are higher rates initially of above-ground biomass accumulation, as well as during the 15 to 25-year period. So rainfall seems to be a very strong driver of the rate of biomass accumulation. This is the biomass change. And before, I showed you Sarabiki data, where we had highest biomass change early, and then it declined. But most of these other sites showed a different trend. They showed lower rates of biomass change initially, leading to higher rates. So we don't always see the same trend in every site. But generally, we found, again here, that growth, increment growth, is the main driver of biomass change. And these dark bars are the rate of change due to increment growth. And those predominate. And mortality is also a very strong factor here. And recruitment is a small component of biomass change. So the similar findings to what we found in the Sarapiquí, Costa Rica study. The absolute rates of biomass accumulation were significantly higher in the three wet versus the three dry forests. So this is the total biomass stock above ground, the wet forests up here, the dry forests down here. Substantial and highly significant difference, even with all the variation that we found. And also, the annual rates of biomass change were higher in the wetter sites compared to the drier sites. And particularly for the growth increment component. So this is obviously a very strong reason why you have more rainfall, trees can grow faster. So they can accumulate carbon faster. That's kind of a no-brainer, but believe it or not, no one had ever demonstrated that with real data. Okay, so that's one of the big take-home messages. So we wanted to go beyond our six sites because we wanted to be able to say a little bit more about this. So we were able to gather a large number of data sets and data authors. All of these people had data from a chronosequence project in the Neotropics where they had followed or been able to calculate biomass accumulation over time in forests of different age within a particular region, generally controlling for local climate, controlling for soils, controlling for history, etc. So we pooled a lot of these studies together and put all the data together. And rather than doing a meta-analysis, we did a new analysis with all of these data. So it involved 45 different forest areas, a total of 65 researchers, almost 1,500 forest plots, lots and lots and lots of tree stems. And in the process, we were able to cover a very wide climatic range. This was the team that got together, and we were there for, I was in Wageningen for Madelon Lobeck's PhD defense, but there we planned and discussed this paper. And it happened. So here are some of the findings. First of all, the dots are all over the place, so that would be above ground biomass across all the sites. The green sites are dry forests, areas with less than 1,500 millimeters of rainfall a year, and you can see they dominate the lower part of this graph. And the wettest sites are these darker blue. So this looks very much like there's an effect of rainfall, but each of these chronosequences was modeled using the data from each site, and then what I'm going to show you in a minute is the above-ground biomass at 20 years. It varies more than sevenfold across the range of these sites. This is the percentage of recovery as opposed to the absolute biomass recovery. And the percentage recovery shows somewhat less of a climatic effect here. Sorry, it's 11-fold variation. I told someone 7 earlier. So this is the above ground modeled for 20 years of regrowth. So we could standardize age across all the sites, and then each of these dots is a different site. And we found a very, very significant and close relationship with rainfall. I mean, this is close for an ecology, right? And if we had more sites in here, we might actually be able to model this as a decline. We're not quite sure if it continues to increase or if it sort of levels off here. But there's a very strong effect of rainfall below 3,000 meters for sure. And this is also true when we model this versus cumulative water deficit, which is an index of how dry or how seasonal the rainfall is and how dry it is when it's dry. And so this also was a very significant factor in predicting above-ground biomass accumulation for 20 years. We looked at other variables as well. Seasonality turned out not to be significant in this study. Carbon exchange capacity, or cation exchange capacity, was significant, but with a very low predictability, and only when we looked at it as a percentage of full recovery. The forest cover surrounding the area did not turn out to be significant, although this was very crudely done, and I think this doesn't mean that there's no effect of surrounding forest cover within a site. This is across sites. And we also didn't find any significant effect of land use prior to forest regeneration, whether it was crops, a shifting cultivation, or pasture. So the big story here was the annual rainfall. And we then were able to model this using climate data. So this is the potential for forest biomes. So you'll see large chunks of South America are not included because it's either the Andes above 1,000 meters or it's Cerrado or not actually a forest biome. So we model this just within forest biomes throughout all of tropical lowland Latin America. And this just assumes that you're starting from no vegetation and how much biomass could be accumulated in that pixel for 20 years. So this ignores existing vegetation. Okay, this is just a map of potential. And you can see that it's generally following climate gradients. Okay. And you can also see a lot of areas, for example, here, and this is a very dry forest in Brazil, very low rates of above-ground biomass accumulation. So this information could be used to determine perhaps priority areas for carbon capture if there is currently no forest in that area. But we wanted to go a little bit further because we wanted to actually say something about existing land use and how we can incorporate that into understanding carbon mitigation, not just look at the potential if all land was cleared, because we know that that's not true. So we wanted to get some idea of what is the potential for second growth forests to accumulate carbon over time beyond our individual study areas. So again, we enlisted pretty much almost the same group of authors because we used the data from the previous study to do this. But we had an initial problem because we didn't have a map of where are the second growth forests. And such a map does not yet exist for a number of reasons. So we decided to estimate this potential by first trying to estimate forest age from an existing biomass map that we were able to obtain. And the biomass map was generated in 2008 by Bassini et al. At Woods Hole. And they used wall-to-wall remote sensing coverages. So they had a global map of the tropics that had standing biomass in 2008. And we were able to project stand age from this because we knew from our biomass formula how much biomass a forest of 10 or 20 years should have in that particular climate zone. And we could compare that with what we actually saw from the biomass map. So we could distinguish areas of mature forest, areas of older secondary forest, and two stages of young secondary forests based on that. So this is our estimated map of forest age as of 2008, and you can see a lot of mature forest here in the Amazon basin. Very little mature forest anywhere else. A few places scattered around in protected areas. But these lighter green areas would be secondary forests that are around 60 years old. The yellow are secondary forests that are around 20 years old. And the red are between 1 and 20 years old. So what we did was just consider the yellow and red, the 1 to 20 and the 20 to 60-year-old size class, because we didn't want to get into issues with selective logging and other kinds of land uses that might be difficult to distinguish from the biomass map. So we thought it'd be safer to just look at where are the young forests and what would happen if those young forests were still alive, for example, now, and were just allowed to grow. How much carbon would they take up in the next 40 years? And that is shown here. So we used our biomass projection rates to do this. And so what you're seeing here now are only those areas that were either at the very young stage or the middle stage of succession. And this is the total amount of carbon in milligrams per hectare that they would take up over a 40-year period. Again, so this is mostly reflecting the climatic restraints that I just showed you earlier that we know are important influences on above-ground carbon sequestration. This is a 100% scenario. This is, you know, assuming, number one, that those forests weren't re-cleared again by now and that they won't be re-cleared at all in the future. So that's a big order. So we also did the simulations for 80% scenario, 60%, 40%, and 20%. And that's what you see here. And this breaks it down into whether the original carbon stocks here in these two solid bars in the two ages of succession, and then these are the additional amounts of carbon during these. That's the 100% scenario, and then this is if a smaller amount of those forests are protected and allowed to regrow. What we found is that if you don't allow even 20% of those forests to regrow, you actually get a negative, so you actually get a net carbon emission because those forests are being removed and they're not available to take up carbon. So we do have a scenario here where if only 20% of those forests are allowed to regrow, that's a negative. We don't get any carbon mitigation from that at all. So the blue bars here is a net sequestration potential. It's pretty much a linear decline as you restrict the forest regrowth potential. And then under this 100% scenario, the above-ground carbon stock pretty much doubles in this young age class. So comparing this orange bar with this bar in 40 years. So we get a total amount of carbon sequestration across this whole region of 8.48 petagrams of carbon. And if you're like me, I kind of looked at that number and I thought, well, what does that mean? is that a lot? Or is that a little? Or is that worth writing a big paper about? So it turns out that translates to 31 petagrams of CO2 and 31.09 petagrams of CO2 is roughly equivalent to the total emissions from fossil fuel and industrial processes for all of the countries of Latin America and the Caribbean from 1993 all the way up to 2014. I couldn't find data for 2015, so that's as far as I could get to the present day. So I had to go backwards. How many years is that? That's 7 plus 13. 21 years to get the amount of, from all that emissions, to get the equal to the amount of carbon storage just in the above ground parts of these young regrowth forests. Okay. So I think it's a lot, actually. And, you know, we had no idea what the magnitude of this could be. Where is that? Well, most of that is in Brazil. And here we break it down into the existing carbon stock and the additional carbon stock. But all of these countries have substantial amounts of second growth forest. And the list goes on. We have this broken down by country as well. So for these countries, this can be an important component in their national determined contributions to climate change. And these countries need to make a plan for how they're going to balance their carbon emissions, reduce emissions, and increase sequestration. Now they have at least some information that they could use to motivate conservation and protection of second growth forests. The other very important point here is that all of this carbon could be stored without planting a single tree. That this is not a tree planting reforestation scenario. This is based on existing forests that are out there. So the price tag for this is only the cost of conserving those forests and protecting them from fire and from cattle grazing and from the other factors that might remove biomass, like harvesting. Which is not an insignificant cost, but it's much, much lower than the cost of replanting trees. And when you go out there and you see places like this where this has happened naturally, it's astounding. Granted that this is not the case everywhere around the tropics, and not everywhere will the potential be there for natural regrowth. But in many cases, in many areas it is, and we're not recognizing that. We don't really have a map to guide us. Where are these places? So this is now becoming an important focus, I hope, of the restoration initiatives to, before planting trees everywhere, or even anywhere, first back up and say, where can natural regeneration happen? In a reasonably high predictability, and we have some good indications of what some of those factors are, and let's try to maximize that form of restoration before we start investing in huge amounts of tree planting in those areas, and let's plant the trees where we really need them and where they're really going to make a difference. And where that whole strategy, that whole sort of cost efficiency strategy, is really what we need to establish the large scale restoration that we need in the world. This is a site in Rio de Janeiro State in Brazil, and it looks a lot like second growth forest, but every single tree you see here in the foreground was planted at great expense. And it's been a highly successful project. And it's likely that because this area was sort of reclaimed land, that it would not have regenerated on its own. But in this same region, on the hills and the foothills of the Sierra, you see huge amounts of natural regeneration. So we can have combinations of planting and natural regeneration that really will create almost continuous cover in certain areas by planning this properly. So I'd just like to end with a little description of another aspect of my work, which is we have formed a network for, it's called the Research Coordination Network, that unites natural and social scientists to try to understand what are the drivers of reforestation in the tropics. We've heard a lot, and we know a lot about the drivers of deforestation. Let's move on, and let's talk about how we can recover and regrow these forests, and what are the factors that have to be considered. A lot of them are social. A lot of them are biophysical. A lot of them are interactions of those two. And we have been working on a number of projects, and one of the important aspects is that in order to create the right conditions for restoration, it requires both matching the restoration approaches to the biophysical conditions in an effective way, but it also includes all of these other things. I'm sorry, I'll go back. Recognizing the frameworks, the social relationships, legitimizing land use, land ownership, developing policy frameworks and ensuring that the people have food security, that those are really important components if you want to try to do restoration. It's not just a matter of regrowing trees because there are people in these landscapes and their lives have to be in good condition in order for that forest to grow and to be maintained. So we are really taking this very, very broad approach. Governance is a very big part of the issue as well. And finally, providing the right kind of economic incentives that are really going to be long-lasting. We're not talking about a 20-year project here, although if that's not how you would think about it when you look at the kind of restoration planning that's going on. We're talking about creating a forest that requires at least 100 perhaps 200 years to really reach its full potential and to really function as a biodiversity reservoir, as well as to protect soils and to store this carbon long term. So this means essentially changing the whole social fabric within those areas so that they want that forest to be there, and that's benefiting them. And that's a real turnaround. I mean, it's a similar issues from when we think about conservation, but it's you're asking them to change their land use as well, and that's a very you have to have something to replace that with that will work for them. So thank you very much, and I'll be happy to take your questions.